is a miracle from God. Globally, that number, based on other surveys, is in the hundreds of millions. Keener nodded. That's right. But I caution, that doesn't necessarily mean they were real miracles. Well, that's true, and maybe the vast majority are coincidences or anomalies or mistakes or fraud or the placebo effect or whatever. Certainly those things happen, and we need to concede that. But can all cases be explained that way? He shook his head. That simply defies reason and ignores the evidence. I took a few moments to flip back through my notes for a quick review of what Keener had said so far. Then I commented, with all the weaknesses in Hume's arguments, it's hard to see how he is still so frequently quoted by skeptics today. I agree. Critics have been pointing out the glaring problems with Hume's work ever since he wrote it, and today those critiques are even stronger. Some are downright brutal. A lot of philosophers from various backgrounds are finally declaring that Emperor Hume has no clothes. Among them is prominent science philosopher John Earman, whose scathing critique, published by Oxford University Press, is titled Hume's Abject Failure. His devastating introduction reads, "It is not simply that Hume's essay does not achieve its goals, but that his goals are ambiguous and confused. Most of Hume's considerations are unoriginal, warmed-over versions of arguments that are found in the writings of predecessors and contemporaries. And parts of miracles that set Hume apart do not stand up to scrutiny. Worse still, the essay reveals the weakness and the poverty of Hume's own account of induction and probabilistic reasoning. And to cap it off, the essay represents the kind of overreaching that gives philosophy a bad name." What was really behind Hume's screed against miracles? Earman is convinced he was motivated by his animus against organized religion, which Hume saw as composed of superstitions that have had almost uniformly baneful effects for mankind. He said Hume was driven by a strong desire to strike a toppling blow against one of the main pillars of faith, leading him to claim more than he could deliver. Incidentally, because of his blistering critique of Hume, some people have questioned whether Earman has a hidden agenda of Christian apologetics. He said that although he appreciates much in the Judeo-Christian heritage, he nevertheless finds nothing attractive, intellectually or emotionally, in the theological doctrines of Christianity. As one reviewer noted, his aim is to sketch an epistemology that allows for both the possibility of miracles and a healthy skepticism toward miracles, twin goals that many theists also embrace. David Johnson, who earned his doctorate in philosophy at Princeton University and is a professor at Yeshiva University, agreed that Hume's arguments on miracles are entirely without merit. In his book, published by Cornell University Press, he said, "The view that there is in Hume's essay any argument or reply or objection that is even superficially good, much less powerful or devastating, is simply a philosophical myth." Philosopher and theologian Keith Ward, now retired from his professorship at Oxford University, called Hume's arguments on miracles exceptionally poor and said they are only acceptable to those who are impressed by his general philosophical acuteness, an acuteness that does not carry over into his remarks on miracles. Ouch. I gestured toward Keener. If Hume's approach doesn't work, then how do you think people should look at claims of miracles? I asked. Keener leaned forward in his chair. I think we should look at the evidence with a healthy dose of skepticism, but also with an open mind, he began. Are there eyewitnesses? When we have multiple, independent, and reliable witnesses, this increases the probability that their testimony is accurate. Do the witnesses have a reputation for honesty? Do they have something to gain or lose? Did they have an opportunity to observe what occurred? Is there corroboration? Are there medical records? What were the precise circumstances and timing of the event? Are there alternative naturalistic explanations for what happened? I pointed out that atheist scientist Jerry Coyne said, "Massive, well-documented, and either replicated or independently corroborated evidence from multiple and reliable sources would be needed to have confidence in a miracle." "Replicable?" Keener replied. "Miracles are one-offs. They are part of history, which can't be repeated. How could we test whether a person was brought back from the dead? Shoot him and try again? I don't think so," he said, chuckling. "But aside from that, we do have plenty of cases that meet the standard Coyne is talking about." "What's the appropriate burden of proof?" I asked. "Many skeptics say extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence." "The question is how to define an ambiguous term like extraordinary. Skeptics often set the bar infinitely high. I think we need sufficient and credible evidence, which varies in each case. The standard needs to be reasonable, so we're not too credulous, but so we don't rule out things at the beginning." "What standard do you suggest?" "In civil law, the standard is more probable than not. That's also the standard most historians apply in their work. So I think this is an appropriate benchmark to apply when evaluating miracle claims. Ultimately, of course, people are going to look at events through their own interpretive grid." "In other words, this really is a worldview issue, isn't it?" I said. "Certainly. If you give miracles a zero chance of ever occurring, as Hume did, then you're not going to find any. But if you keep an open mind and follow the evidence wherever it leads, well, it might take you to unexpected places." Pen in hand, I turned to a blank page of my notebook. That's exactly where I wanted to go next. Chapter 6. A Tide of Miracles. A physician picked up Craig Keener's 2-volume book on miracles with one goal in mind: to reinforce his highly skeptical worldview. I was ready to see through yet another theologian who didn't know much about psychosomatic illnesses, temporary improvements with no long-term follow-up, incorrect medical diagnoses, conversion disorders, faked cures, self-deception, and the like, he said. But he admitted, I was blindsided. After plowing through the philosophical chapters, he came across the thousands of case studies that form the core of Keener's book, reports of extraordinary healings and other incredible events backed up by eyewitnesses and, in many cases, clear-cut corroborating evidence. I read them with the critical eye of a skeptic, having many years of medical practice under the belt, the doctor said. Many reports weren't sufficiently documented to convince him. In other instances, he could envision alternative, naturalistic explanations to account for what happened. But not in all cases. "Not by a long shot," he said. "I found hundreds of case studies to be stunning. They couldn't just be dismissed with a knowing answer and a cheery wave of the hand. With respect to my worldview, I had had the chair pulled out from underneath me." Such is the persuasive power of the evidence for many miraculous claims. It's even enough to win over, well, Keener himself. "When I was an atheist, of course, I didn't believe the miraculous was possible," Keener told me. "But even after I came to faith, I still retained quite a bit of skepticism. As a Christian, I believed in miracles in principle, but I have to admit I doubted the veracity of many claims I would hear." "Your work as a historian probably influenced you in that regard," I suggested. "Yes, we're taught to think critically, to demand convincing sources, and almost to use a hermeneutic of suspicion. Academics often take the attitude, doubt all that you can, and then if anything is left at the end, you may accept it, but only tentatively." "There can be a professional risk to investigating this topic, right?" no doubt. When I embarked on this project, I was concerned about being labeled a bad scholar because I chose to examine and document these cases. Frankly, it's safer for academics to stay stymied in their skepticism rather than to seek after the truth. My mind flashed to a professor I had interviewed at a highly respected public university. He told me in detail how he had been incredibly healed of a brain tumor after praying to Jesus. But he wouldn't allow me to publish his story. Why? "I'm up for tenure," he said. "I'm afraid my colleagues would skewer me." Nevertheless, Keener told me he tried to maintain intellectual honesty in his research and to follow the clues wherever they led. And where did those clues take him? Everywhere I looked, I came across miracle claims that better fit a supernatural explanation than a naturalistic conclusion. Pretty soon, there was a tidal wave of examples. "Such as?" "Such as," he repeated, eager to take up the challenge. Keener mentally scrolled through examples from the case studies he had encountered, and he began speaking in a tone that was at once urgent and earnest. "Cataracts and goiters, instantly and visibly healed," he said. "Paralytics, suddenly able to walk. Multiple sclerosis, radically cured. Broken bones, suddenly mended. Hearing for the deaf. Sight for the blind. Voices restored. Burns disappearing. Massive hemorrhaging stopped. Failing kidneys cured. Rheumatoid arthritis and osteoporosis gone. Life given back to the dead, even after several hours. I have accounts from around the world. China, Mozambique, the Philippines, Nigeria, Argentina, Brazil, Cuba, Ecuador, Indonesia, South Korea, and other countries. Multiple and independent eyewitnesses with reputations for integrity, including physicians. Names, dates, medical documentation in many cases. There's even a peer-reviewed scientific study confirming the healing of the deaf. And the timing is usually the most dramatic element. Instantaneous results right after prayers to Jesus. Lots of cancer healings too. Malignant brain tumors and reticulum cell sarcoma, for instance. But I didn't include most of those in the book since I knew people would write them off as spontaneous remissions. Still, when the remission happens so quickly and completely after specific prayers, it's very suspicious. And your conclusion from all this is what? That apart from some divine intervention, many of these phenomena seem inexplicable. In other words, a lot of these cases better fit a supernatural explanation than a natural one. I asked, "What was the turning point for you?" His answer turned out to be a very personal one indeed. For years, Keener had heard vague stories about his wife's older sister, Therese Magnuha, who had been, what, revived, resuscitated, raised from the dead? It wasn't until Keener flew to Africa and trekked through Congo-Brazzaville that he found out firsthand from eyewitnesses what had actually occurred. It was the family connection that gave his experience an especially profound meaning for him. "How old was Therese when this happened?" I asked. "She was 2. One day her mother went out for a short time to take some food to a neighbor. When she returned, Therese was crying. She had been bitten by a snake. Her mother strapped the child to her back so she could run for help, but she quickly discovered that the child had stopped breathing. There were no clinics or doctors. She carried her child up a mountainous area and back down the other side in order to find a family friend, Coco Nguma Moyes. She calculated that Therese had stopped breathing for more than 3 hours. 3 hours, I echoed. Brain damage begins after just 6 minutes without oxygen. That's right. With no medical assistance available, all they could do after arriving was to pray to Jesus. They did. And as they lifted their cries to heaven, Therese began breathing again. Did she suffer any ill effects? That's the other amazing thing. No. She promptly recovered, and by the next day she was fine. She recently completed a graduate-level seminary degree in preparation for full-time ministry, so there was no brain damage or other problems. My skepticism kicked in. "Let me guess," I said. "They were part of an exuberant, charismatic church where spectacular, miraculous claims like this abound." He shook his head. "No, they're part of a mainline Protestant denomination." "With no doctors around, was there any way of knowing whether or not she had actually died?" I asked. "This is a culture where people personally encounter death a lot more than Westerners do. They know what it looks like. Plus, a mother has every reason to grasp at the hope of any breath she could find. But let's say she wasn't clinically dead. Nevertheless, at the very minimum, it would be an astounding recovery, especially given the timing, right after the prayers began." Because of the family connection, the incident resonated deeply with Keener. But in reading page after page of miracle accounts in his book, it wasn't even among the best attested. "Of all the cases you examine, what are some of the strongest in terms of witnesses and corroborating evidence?" I asked. Keener smiled and sat back in his chair. "How long do you have?" he asked. With that, Keener began recounting some of the stories he had investigated. He started with the case of a 9-year-old British girl who was diagnosed with deafness in September 1982, apparently the result of a virus that severely damaged nerves in both of her ears. Her case is reported by Dr. R.F.R. Gardner, a well-credentialed physician, Keener said. "What makes this case especially interesting is that there is medical confirmation before the healing and immediately afterward, which is unusual to have. The child's medical record says she was diagnosed with untreatable bilateral sensory-neural deafness. Her attending physician told her parents there was no cure and nothing he could do to repair her damaged nerves. She was outfitted with hearing aids that did help her hear to some degree. The girl didn't want to be wearing hearing aids the rest of her life, so she started to pray that God would heal her. Her family and friends joined her. In fact, her mother said she felt a definite prompting to call out for God's help. 'I kept feeling God was telling me to pray specifically for healing,' she said. 'Passages kept coming out to me as I read, "If you have faith like children, if one among you is ill, lay hands. Ask and you shall receive. Your faith has made you whole."' On March 8, 1983, the girl went to the audiologist because one of her hearing aids had been damaged at school. After being examined and refitted, she went home. The next evening, the child suddenly jumped out of bed without her hearing aids and came bounding down the stairs. 'Mummy, I can hear,' she exclaimed. Her mother, astonished, tested to see if she could detect noises and words, and she could, even whispers. Her mother called the audiologist, who said, 'I don't believe you. It's not possible.' 'All right, if some miracle has happened, I'm delighted. Have audiograms done.' The following day, she was tested again, and her audiogram and tympanogram came back fully normal. 'I can give no explanation for this,' said the audiologist. 'I have never seen anything like it in my life.' The girl's doctor ruled out possible medical explanations. After repeated successful audiograms, the dumbfounded consultant's advice to her parents? Forget she was ever deaf. In the medical report, the doctor's ear, nose, and throat surgeon used the word inexplicable to describe what happened. He wrote, "An audiogram did show her hearing in both ears to be totally and completely normal. I was completely unable to explain this phenomenon, but naturally, like her parents, I was absolutely delighted. I can think of no rational explanation as to why her hearing returned to normal, there being a severe bilateral sensory-neural loss." After documenting numerous case studies like this in his book, Gardner concludes, "A belief in the occurrence of cases of miraculous healing today is intellectually acceptable." He said people who are still skeptical should consider what evidence they would be prepared to accept. If the answer proves to be none, then you had better face the fact that you have abandoned logical inquiry. Keener went on to discuss another case, not in his book, for which there's significant documentation. I've personally interviewed Barbara, who was diagnosed at the Mayo Clinic with progressive multiple sclerosis, Keener said. I've confirmed the facts with two physicians who treated her. There are numerous independent witnesses to her condition and years of medical records. In fact, two of her doctors were so astounded by her case that they've written about it in books. One of those physicians, Dr. Harold P. Adolph, a board-certified surgeon who performed nearly 25,000 operations in his career, declared, "Barbara was one of the most hopelessly ill patients I ever saw." Another physician, Dr. Thomas Marshall, an internist for 30 years until his recent retirement, described Barbara as a budding gymnast in high school, playing flute in the orchestra. But symptoms began appearing. She would trip, bump into walls, and was unable to grasp the rings in gym class. Eventually, after her condition worsened, the diagnosis of progressive multiple sclerosis was confirmed through spinal taps and other diagnostic tests. After thoroughly examining her case, doctors at the Mayo Clinic agreed with the dire diagnosis. "The prognosis was not good," Marshall said. "Over the next 16 years, her condition continued to deteriorate. She spent months in hospitals, often for pneumonia after being unable to breathe. One diaphragm was paralyzed, rendering a lung non-functional. The other lung operated at less than 50%. A tracheostomy tube was inserted into her neck, with oxygen pumped from canisters in her garage. She lost control of her urination and bowels. A catheter had to be inserted into her bladder, and an ileostomy was performed, with a bag attached for her bodily waste. She went legally blind, unable to read, and only capable of seeing objects as gray shadows. A feeding tube was inserted into her stomach. Her abdomen was swollen grotesquely because the muscles of her intestine did not work," Adolph said. "She now needed continuous oxygen, and her muscles and joints were becoming contracted and deformed because she could not move or exercise them," Marshall said. "Mayo Clinic was her last hope, but they had no recommendations to help stop this progressive wasting disease except to pray for a miracle." By 1981, she hadn't been able to walk for 7 years. She was confined to bed, her body twisted like a pretzel into a fetal position. Her hands were permanently flexed to the point that her fingers nearly touched her wrists. Her feet were locked in a downward position. Marshall explained to her family that it was just a matter of time before she would die. They agreed not to do any heroics, including CPR or further hospitalization, to keep her alive. This would only prolong the inevitable. Barbara entered hospice in her home, with a life expectancy of less than 6 months. One day, someone called in Barbara's story to the radio station of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. A request was broadcast for listeners to pray fervently for her. Some 450 Christians wrote letters to her church saying that they were lifting up Barbara in prayer. On Pentecost Sunday, 1981, her aunt came over to read her some of the letters in which people offered prayers for her healing. Two girlfriends joined them. Suddenly, during a lull in the conversation, Barbara heard a man's voice from behind her, even though there was nobody else in the room. The words were clear and articulate and spoken with great authority, but also with great compassion, Marshall wrote. Said the voice, "My child, get up and walk." Seeing that Barbara had become agitated, one of her friends plugged the hole in her neck so she could speak. "I don't know what you're going to think about this," Barbara told him, "but God just told me to get up and walk. I know he really did. Run and get my family. I want them here with us." Her friends ran out and yelled for her family, "Come quick, come quick!" Marshall described what happened next. Barb felt compelled to do immediately what she was divinely instructed, so she literally jumped out of bed and removed her oxygen. She was standing on legs that had not supported her for years. Her vision was back, and she was no longer short of breath, even without her oxygen. Her contractions were gone, and she could move her feet and hands freely. Her mother ran into the room and dropped to her knees, feeling Barbara's calves. "You have muscles again," she exclaimed. Her father came in, hugged her, and whisked her off for a waltz around the family room, Marshall said. Everyone moved to the family room to offer a tearful prayer of thanksgiving, although Barbara found it hard to sit still. That evening, there was a worship service at Wheaton Wesleyan Church, where Barbara's family attended. Most of the congregation knew about Barbara's grave condition. During the service, when the pastor asked if anyone had any announcements, Barbara stepped into the center aisle and casually strolled toward the front, her heart pounding. "A cacophony of whispers came from all parts of the church," Marshall said. "People started clapping, and then, as if led by a divine conductor, the entire congregation began to sing, 'Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found, was blind, but now I see.'" The next day, Barbara came into Marshall's office for an examination. "Seeing her in the hallway, walking toward him, I thought I was seeing an apparition," he recalled. No one had ever seen anything like this before. He told Barbara, "This is medically impossible, but you are now free to go out and live your life." A chest x-ray that afternoon showed her lungs were already perfectly normal, with the collapsed lung completely expanded. The intestine that had been vented to the abdominal wall was reconnected normally, Adolf said. She was eventually restored to complete health. Barbara has now lived for 35 years with no recurrence of her illness. She subsequently married a minister and feels her calling in life is to serve others, Marshall said. Both physicians marvel at her extraordinary recovery. "I have never witnessed anything like this before or since and considered it a rare privilege to observe the hand of God performing a true miracle," Marshall wrote. Said Adolf, "Both Barbara and I knew who had healed her." I sat in silence for a while, flabbergasted by Barbara's story. Keener shared my amazement. When I interviewed Barbara about her case, she was still brimming with excitement, even after all these years, he said. My mind searched fruitlessly for naturalistic explanations. Could her recovery be written off as some sort of natural remission? If so, why would it suddenly occur after so many years, right when hundreds of people were praying for her? Remissions typically take place over time. Certainly, the placebo effect or misdiagnosis or fraud or coincidence or medical mistakes couldn't account for what happened. Besides, what about the mysterious voice telling her to get up and walk? Or the immediate muscle tone in her atrophied legs? Or the instant and simultaneous healing of her eyesight, lungs, and so on. With so many witnesses of unquestioned integrity and expertise, plus a proliferation of corroborating documentation, her case seemed to meet even the high evidential bar typically set by skeptics. Absent a presupposition against the miraculous, this did seem to be a clear and compelling example of divine intervention. And Keener was far from finished. He began to rattle off a series of other amazing stories he had documented in his book, including the story of Carl Cockerell. In March 2006, on a trip to Missouri, Carl was checking the oil in his car when he stepped down and felt a sharp crack, Keener said. He fainted from the pain, which was the worst he had ever endured. I have a copy of the radiology report of his x-rays, confirming the fracture. the orthopedist ordered him to stay overnight. During that night, though, Carl experienced a voice from the Lord. "What did the voice say?" I asked. "That the ankle was not broken." I cocked my head. "Despite the x-rays?" "That's right." The next day, the doctor casted his leg and warned he would eventually need months of physical therapy. Back in Michigan, his family doctor ordered more x-rays, and this time the results were radically different. How so? There were no breaks or even tissue damage where a break had been. Again, I have the radiology report that says there's no fracture. In fact, the doctor told him, "You never had a broken ankle." "But," I interjected, "what about the Missouri x-rays?" Keener calmly continued the narrative. The doctor looked again at those Missouri x-rays and said, "Now, that's a broken ankle." But at this point, there was no sign of a break. He removed Carl's cast and sent him home. Carl never had further problems or needed any therapy. "What do you make of all that?" I asked. "Personally, I don't see how this could have occurred naturally," Keener said. "Would a 62-year-old man's bone heal so quickly that no sign of a fracture would remain at all? It doesn't seem likely. And of course, that wouldn't explain how God told him in advance what would happen." Next, Keener brought up Ed Wilkinson, whose education in neuropsychology convinced him that people who rely on faith to cure their ills are merely using religion as a neurosis to avoid dealing with reality. Then, in November 1984, his 8-year-old son, Brad, was diagnosed with 2 holes in his heart. The condition also impaired his lungs. Surgery was scheduled, Keener recounted. As the surgery got closer, Brad started giving away his toys, not expecting he would survive. One day he asked his dad, "Am I going to die?" "That's quite a question, given the circumstances," I said. "Was his father honest with him?" He said, "Not everyone who has heart surgery dies, but it can happen." Then his son asked, "Can Jesus heal me?" "Now, that's quite a question," I said. His father was aware of how often faith is abused, so he said, "I'll get back to you on that." And did he? Yes, a few days later, after some anguished prayers and reading Philippians 4, verse 13, Ed told him that God does heal, but whether or not he would in Brad's case, they still had hope of eternal life in Jesus. After that, a visiting pastor asked Brad, "Do you believe that Jesus can heal you?" Brad said, "Yes," and the minister prayed for him. Before surgery at the University of Missouri Hospital in Columbia, Missouri, tests confirmed nothing had changed with Brad's condition. The following morning, Brad was taken in for his operation, which was expected to last 4 hours. But after an hour, the surgeon summoned Ed and showed him 2 films. The first film, taken the day before, showed blood leaking from one heart chamber to another. The second film, taken just as surgery started, showed a wall of some sort where the leak had been. The surgeon said there was nothing wrong with Brad's heart, even though the holes were clearly visible the day before. The lungs were also now normal. "I have not seen this very often," the surgeon said. He explained that a spontaneous closure rarely happens in infants, but it was not supposed to occur in an 8-year-old. "You can count this as a miracle," he said. The hospital risk manager said firmly, "You can see from the films this was not a misdiagnosis." Added the pulmonologist, "Somebody, somewhere, must have been praying." Later, an insurance agent called Ed to explain about the forms he had submitted. "What's a spontaneous closure?" the agent asked. Replied Ed, "A miracle." "Today," said Keener, "Brad is in his 30s with a business and children of his own. He has never had any heart problems since his healing." Keener continued with the case of Jeff Markin, a 53-year-old auto mechanic who walked into the emergency room at Palm Beach Gardens Hospital in Florida and collapsed from a heart attack on October the 20th, 2006. For 40 minutes, emergency room personnel frantically labored to revive him, shocking him 7 times with the defibrillator, but he remained flatlined. Finally, the supervising cardiologist, Chauncey Crandell, a well-respected Yale-educated doctor and medical school professor who specialized in complex heart cases, was brought in to examine the body. Markin's face, toes, and fingers had already turned black from the lack of oxygen. His pupils were dilated and fixed. There was no point in trying to resuscitate him. At 8:05 p.m., he was declared dead. Crandell filled out the final report and turned to leave. But he quickly felt an extraordinary compulsion. "I sensed God was telling me to turn around and pray for the patient," he said later. This seemed foolish, so he tried to ignore it, only to receive a second and even stronger divine prompting. A nurse was already disconnecting the intravenous fluids and sponging the body so it could be taken to the morgue. But Crandell began praying over the corpse. "Father God, I cry out for the soul of this man. If he does not know you as his Lord and Savior, please raise him from the dead right now in Jesus' name." Crandell told the emergency room doctor to use the paddle to shock the corpse one more time. Seeing nothing to gain, the doctor protested, "I've shocked him again and again. He's dead." But then he complied out of respect for his colleague. Instantly, the monitor jumped from flatline to a normal heartbeat of 75 beats per minute with a healthy rhythm. "In my more than 20 years as a cardiologist, I've never seen a heartbeat restored so completely and suddenly," Crandell said. Markin immediately began breathing without any assistance, and the blackness receded from his face, toes, and fingers. The nurse panicked because she feared the patient would be permanently disabled from oxygen deprivation, and yet he never displayed any signs of brain damage. Keener shook his head in wonder. "As you can imagine, this case got a lot of attention in the media," he said. "One medical consultant for a national news program suggested that perhaps Markin's heart had not stopped completely, but had gone into a very subtle rhythm for those 40 minutes. "What was Crandell's response?" I asked. "That he was grasping at straws. The resuscitation couldn't have happened naturally. An electrical shock administered in those circumstances would not normally accomplish anything," Keener said. "The unanimous verdict of those actually present was that Markin was deceased, and that includes Crandell. Indeed, in light of the circumstances, skeptical explanations seem hollow and forced. And again, they can't account for the two mysterious urges that prompted Crandell to turn in his tracks and pray for a victim who had already been declared dead. Absent those, Jeff Markin would be in his grave today." The critics have to strain at the bounds of plausibility in order to keep their anti-supernatural thesis intact, Keener said. "For me, Acts 26, verse 8 sprang to mind. Why should any of you consider it incredible that God raises the dead?" I knew Keener could go on for hours talking about the cases he unearthed in his admittedly limited survey of miraculous claims. For example, he has accumulated 350 reports just of people who've been healed of blindness. Here are several cases taken at random from his book. A welder named David Dominong suffered extensive third and fourth degree burns when he was electrocuted in October 2002. Hospitalized for more than 5 weeks, he was told it could be 5 years until he would be able to walk again. He was confined to a wheelchair and considering amputation when he received prayer and was promptly able to walk and run without assistance. Dr. Alex Abraham testified to the case of Keldoop Singh, who had intractable leprosy to the point where he would lose consciousness during frequent seizures. Ever since Pastor Jarnail Singh prayed that God would heal him 15 years ago, he has had no more seizures or treatment. Abraham, a neurologist, said the abrupt, permanent, and complete healing of leprosy this severe is highly unusual. Matthew Dawson was hospitalized in Australia with confirmed meningitis in April 2007. He was told he would have to remain under hospital care for weeks or months. but he was abruptly healed at the exact moment his father, on another continent, offered prayers for him. Mirtha Venero Bosa, a medical doctor in Cuba, reports that her baby granddaughter's hand was severely burned by a hot iron, resulting in swelling and skin peeling off. Less than half an hour after prayer, however, the hand was completely healed without medical intervention, as if it had never been burned. Cambridge University professor John Polkinghorne, one of the world's foremost scholars at the intersection of science and faith, provides the account of a woman whose left leg was paralyzed in an injury. Doctors gave up trying to treat her, saying she would be an invalid for life. In 1980, she reluctantly agreed to prayer from an Anglican priest. Though she had no expectation of healing, she had a vision in which she was commanded to rise and walk. Said Polkinghorne, who has doctorates in both science and theology, "From that moment, she was able to walk, jump, and bend down completely without pain." Physician John White reports that a woman with a confirmed diagnosis of tuberculosis of the cervical spine had been unable to walk, but she was instantaneously healed after prayer. He said her doctor was bewildered to find that there was no evidence of disease in her body. Said Keener, "Her illness was certain, her cure permanent, and the witness virtually incontrovertible." Not only was White the doctor who prayed for her, but he later married her. Joy Wainfried, a student at Taylor University in Indiana, suffered from vertical heterophoria, where one eye viewed images at a higher level than the other. This triggered debilitating migraines that could last up to a week. A professor and students prayed for her during three consecutive prayer meetings, and Joy was suddenly healed, her eyesight now 20/20, and her incurable medical condition gone. Her eye doctor said she can't explain it and has never seen anything like it in 4,000 patients. Keener, who has copies of her before and after medical reports, confirmed that she no longer even needs corrective lenses. A grapefruit-sized flesh-eating ulcer with the wound going to the bone was boring through the calf muscle of a 70-year-old Florida man. After treatments failed, doctors declared the wound incurable and amputation was scheduled. However, one physician laid his hands on the oozing wound and prayed for healing. Recovery began immediately. Within 4 days, the ulcer was melting away and new skin forming. By the following week, the leg was restored to normal. The doctor's opinion? It can't happen on its own. Impossible. The patient's wife summed it up. God's real. God healed his leg. University professor Robert Larmer reports that Mary Ellen Fitch was hospitalized with hepatitis B. She was turning yellow. Her abdomen bulged with her swollen liver. She was told she would remain in the hospital for months. After a week, though, she had a deep experience with God and committed her condition to Him. The next morning, her blood tests were normal. Bewildered doctors repeatedly tested her with the same results. Years have now passed, and she remains healed. The director of a clinic for voice and swallowing disorders reports the case of a 52-year-old man who suffered a severe brainstem stroke in the region of the medulla. Strokes in this location irreversibly damage the ability to swallow. After prayer, though, the man regained his ability to eat and swallow normally. The patient told the startled experts, "I know, it's a miracle." This was the only such recovery the clinic's director had seen in 15 years. Page after page, Keener unfolds so many miracle claims that after a while it's easy to become numb to them. Many of them come from his own circle of acquaintances, which means he's only scratching the surface of the number of supernatural accounts out there. Although the amount of witnesses and documentation varies in different cases, many of them seem to exceed even the stringent standards suggested by skeptics. As impressive as those reports are, though, I decided to change the direction of the conversation by bringing up Michael Shermer's question about why we don't see reports of God miraculously regrowing the limbs of amputees. When I posed the challenge to Keener, he considered the issue for a few moments before responding. Interestingly, we see many amazing miracles performed by Jesus, including the healing of a withered hand, but we don't see amputated limbs restored, he replied. While I've heard stories of limbs growing back, I haven't verified or personally examined any of them at this point. He searched his memory and added, Douglas Norwood, a pastor in Suriname at the time, tells of a Christian gathering that was attended by an opponent of the church who had a shriveled arm, paralyzed his whole life. He shouted, I defy this Christian God. With that, suddenly his arm shot up into the air, fully healed. He looked at it and was instantly converted. In fact, this was the beginning of a movement where tens of thousands of people came to faith in Christ in Suriname. There's also the case of a Wisconsin man crushed under a semi-trailer, destroying most of his small intestine, Keener continued. He was slowly starving to death because he couldn't digest food. He dropped to 125 pounds from 180. A friend felt God was leading him to fly from New York just to pray for him. When he prayed, the man felt something like an electric jolt going through his body. He was healed. In fact, a medical report says his small intestine had more than doubled in length. A small intestine in an adult can get wider, but it can't get longer. That's an example of a body part growing back, but I'm not sure that's what Shermer was getting at, I said. I think he was saying that he needs to see a more visible healing, something irrefutable. We've got plenty of those, Keener said. For instance, totally blind eyes, white from cataracts, changing color and becoming normal and healthy. That's hard to explain away. Still, I said, a lot of your stories are from Africa, Asia, and other faraway places. Why do so many of these dramatic miracles happen in distant and underdeveloped countries where documentation is particularly difficult? In America, we have a lot of sophisticated medical technology, which is God's gift to us, and we should use it. That's the way He typically brings healing, Keener said. But in many other places around the world, that's not available, and perhaps God's intervention is the only hope in a lot of instances. I noted that philosopher J.P. Moreland explained that outbreakings of the supernatural tend to occur in areas where there's leading-edge evangelism into new cultures. In his book, Kingdom Triangle, Moreland writes, a major factor in the current revival in the Third World, by some estimates up to 70% of it, is intimately connected to signs and wonders as expressions of the love of the Christian Father God, the Lordship of His Son, and the power of His Spirit and His kingdom. Keener agreed. We get lots of instances like this, he said. Some estimate that 90% of the growth of the church in China is being fueled by healings. Edmund Tang at the University of Birmingham said, this is especially true in the countryside, where medical facilities are often inadequate or non-existent. Intrigued, I asked Keener if he had other examples, which he readily offered. Dr. Julia Ma at the Oxford Center for Mission Studies said most converts among the Kankanae in the northern Philippines came to Christ through the experience of miraculous healings, he said. A Baptist church in India grew from 6 members to more than 600 in just over a year because of healings. In Ethiopia, more than 80% of believers surveyed in a Lutheran church attributed their conversions to healings and exorcisms. In Brazil, many poor people lack adequate health care, and they're attracted to Christianity when they see healings. 86% of Brazilian Pentecostals said that they had an experience of divine healing, he added. In Argentina, healing is by far the primary tool for evangelism and church growth. I thought of comments by the late Jim Rutz, who used to live close to me when I resided in Colorado. He documented the recent growth of the Christian church worldwide, taking special note of God's supernatural intervention, including accounts of people being brought back from the dead in 52 countries. Since about the mid-1980s, a tide of miracles has begun to engulf the entire planet, he wrote in his book Megashift. As time goes on, miracles are multiplying like loaves and fishes. Pretty soon, Keener and I began hearing some noises coming from upstairs. Sounds like Medine has come home from teaching her French class, Keener said. I'd like for you to meet her. Absolutely, I'd love to meet her, I replied. But before we go, let me ask you something else. You set out to accomplish two things with your book. Did you achieve what you had hoped? My first goal involved the New Testament, he replied. I wanted to show that it's not necessary to dismiss these writings as legendary, fanciful, or inaccurate just because they report miracles. Today's world is full of first-hand claims from people who say they have witnessed miracles, and there's no reason to suppose the ancient world was any different. If today's accounts can stem from eyewitnesses and potentially report what really happened, then the same is true of the Gospels. Clearly, that goal had been achieved. And what was your second goal, I asked? To show that it's rational to consider the possibility of supernatural causation for many of these miracle claims. Well, Professor, that's very academic sounding, I said with a grin. Okay, let me rephrase it, he said, clearing his throat. It looks like God is still in the miracle business. He stopped for a moment to let that simple declarative sentence hang in the air. Then he added, at least that's an entirely reasonable hypothesis from the evidence. Often, the best explanation for what occurred is supernatural, not natural. What are some of the implications of this? I asked. Anti-supernaturalism has reigned as an inflexible Western academic premise for far too long. In light of the millions of people around the globe who say they've experienced the miraculous, it's time to take these claims seriously. Let's investigate them and follow the evidence wherever it leads. If even a small fraction proved to be genuine, we have to consider whether God is still divinely intervening in His creation. I closed my notebook and put my pen in my shirt pocket. And you believe he is? I asked. Keener's voice was unwavering. This time, he answered not merely as a scholar, but also as a relative of the healed Therese. Yes, I believe he is. Part 3. Science, Dreams, and Visions. Chapter 7. The Science of Miracles. An interview with Dr. Candy Gunther Brown. That's not good for your side, Lee. That taunt from skeptic Michael Shermer played in my mind as I drove northward on Interstate 65 the day after my interview with Craig Keener in rural Kentucky. Shermer was referring to a scientific analysis of prayer's impact on the recovery of cardiac bypass patients, conducted by the founder of Harvard Medical School's Mind-Body Medical Institute and known as STEP, or the Study of the Therapeutic Effects of Intercessory Prayer, the decade-long research certainly seemed to have impressive credentials. Technically, it was a prospective, randomized, double-blind, parallel group-controlled trial, a so-called gold standard in research. It cost $2.4 million and was published in the peer-reviewed American Heart Journal. However, the results were deflating to those who expected confirmation of prayer's miraculous healing power. The study's conclusion? Prayer recipients fared no better than those who weren't prayed for. Zero, nothing, was how Shermer crisply summarized what Stepp concluded about the effects of prayer. This is the best prayer study we have, he said. So, when you get beyond anecdotes and use the scientific method, there's no evidence for the miraculous. When he added, "That's not good for your side, Lee," it was easy to detect a whiff of triumphalism in his voice. Science, of course, is not the only route to certainty. Believing that science is the sole arbiter of truth is called scientism, which is self-refuting. In other words, the sentence, science is the only way to know if something is true, is itself not a claim that can be proven by science. Science aside, my interview with Keener illustrated that corroborated eyewitness testimony, especially when coming from multiple and independent observers who have unquestioned integrity, can go a long way in establishing whether a miracle claim is credible. Still, there are ways that science and medicine can contribute to the investigation of the supernatural. It's true that miracles can't be analyzed in a test tube. However, it's also true that test tubes can be used to determine whether a virus has suddenly disappeared from the blood of a hepatitis patient immediately after prayer. Important corroboration for a claim of a supernatural healing. In 1997, Harvard paleontologist and evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould, a self-described agnostic, wrote that science and faith occupy non-overlapping magisteria. By that, he meant that science deals with the empirical universe, facts and theories, while religion focuses on questions of moral meaning and value. Gould's vision was that there ought to be respectful discourse and constant input from both magisteria toward the common goal of wisdom. In other words, science and faith, working side by side, can bring new understandings about our life and world. While that's a laudable goal, Gould's rigid delineation of the roles of science and faith has been hotly debated. For example, Christianity isn't merely concerned with moral meaning and value. It makes specific factual claims about events, including miracles such as the resurrection, that have occurred in history. If those claims aren't actually true, the faith collapses and its moral authority evaporates. Certainly, the use of scientific expertise can help in investigating whether claims of the miraculous are valid or not. Even if science cannot definitively prove God exists or that something supernatural has occurred, it can provide empirical evidence that either supports or undermines miracle accounts. After all, Jesus wasn't adverse to his own miracles being scrutinized. He told eyewitnesses to his miracles to report what they had personally seen, and he instructed a person healed of leprosy to show himself to the priest so he could be examined. So, what is the legitimate role of science in investigating supernatural claims? Equally important, what can't it contribute? And is STEP the final word on the efficacy of intercessory prayer? Does this study really establish, as Michael Shermer suggested, that when scientific analysis is applied, there is no persuasive evidence for the miraculous? Those were some of the questions prompting my nearly 200-mile journey northward from Keener's house to the campus of Indiana University in Bloomington. I checked my watch as I drove my rental car. Still plenty of time to make my appointment with a Harvard-educated scholar who is figuring out ways to use the magisterium of science to investigate the magisterium of faith. Candy Gunther Brown, who earned her undergraduate degree summa cum laude, master's degree, and doctorate at Harvard, is a professor of religious studies at the sprawling Indiana University, which has 48,000 students on its campus, 50 miles southwest of Indianapolis. A scrupulous scholar eager to maintain academic neutrality, Brown takes a non-sectarian approach to religious studies. I do not assume the existence or non-existence of a deity or other suprahuman forces, she explains. What I argue is that people's religious beliefs often have real-world effects that can be studied empirically. Her books include Testing Prayer, Science and Healing, published by Harvard University Press, and The Healing Gods, Complementary and Alternative Medicine in Christian America, published by Oxford University Press. And she is the editor of Global Pentecostal and Charismatic Healing, also published by Oxford. Brown has taught a variety of courses at the university, including Religion, Illness, and Healing, sickness and health, and evangelical and charismatic Christianity in the Americas. She's a popular online writer for the Huffington Post and Psychology Today, and her peer-reviewed articles have appeared in Academic Medicine and numerous other scholarly journals. What brought me to Indiana was her focus on studying the impact of intercessory prayer on healing. Since the university's campus was bustling with traffic and parking was at a premium, we decided to meet at the nearby house she shares with her husband, Joshua, who's also a professor at the university, specializing in cognitive science and neuroscience. Wearing her dark hair short and parted on the side, and peering through black-rimmed glasses, Brown is a live wire, bounding with energy, her voice strong and clear from years of lecturing in classrooms. She thinks and speaks in a well-organized manner, unfolding her points systematically and with clarity. We chose adjacent wingback chairs in her front sitting room and settled in for our discussion. "What's your response to skeptics who say science shouldn't investigate prayers for healing?" I asked her. For instance, the textbook Psychology of Religion says, "The evidence of the effectiveness of prayers as they touch events in the material world remain outside the domain of science. The faithful who want to believe can believe, and the skeptic who chooses not to believe could not be convinced." Replied Brown, "I think that ignores a third category of people, which may be the largest, those who don't have a predetermined conclusion. These people just want to know where the facts point." "They're open to wherever the evidence leads them," I said. "Exactly. Let's face it, people get sick, and when they do, they often pray for healing. Whether scientists or medical doctors think that's a good idea or not, it's going to happen. So it only makes sense to find out what occurs when there are prayers for healing. Are they beneficial, whether for natural or supernatural reasons? Or do they cause people to get worse? Policymakers, scientists, physicians, patients, it's relevant to all of them. How can science be used to investigate the effects of prayers? In several ways. For one thing, medical records can be compared before and after prayer occurs. Was there a condition that was diagnosed? Do x-rays, blood tests, and other diagnostic procedures show illness or injury? And then, was there some resolution of that condition? Of course, you can't prove God healed them, even if their illness disappears, I observed. Correct. There may have been medical treatment, or the placebo effect may be involved, or spontaneous remission. Even diagnostic tests can be open to interpretation. Plus, relapses might occur later, she replied. On the other hand, if there's no improvement or a worsening of their illness, then we can say a miracle cure definitely didn't take place. Science is better at disproving things than proving them. Clinical studies can be helpful too, I offered. I believe so. They're set up for a short-term window of time so we can measure what happens after people pray. Now, there can be complications, such as people outside the study who are praying for people inside the study, or the application of medical treatment or subsequent relapses. And of course, everyone brings their own assumptions when they interpret the data, depending on where they are on the spectrum. The spectrum? Yes, on one end of the spectrum are those who expect miracles to be very, very likely. They believe God frequently intervenes in nature. They may be quick to conclude God has healed this person through prayer. But people on the opposite end of the spectrum start with the assumption that miracles never happen. If there's a zero likelihood, then regardless of how strong the evidence is, there has to be a more plausible explanation, right? So there's going to be a preconditioning to interpret things depending on where you start off. I asked Brown for her opinion of the STEP project that Shermer had cited as having no impact or even a slightly harmful effect on recovering cardiac patients. I anticipated this to be a rather routine conversation, but frankly, I ended up thoroughly surprised, even stunned, by what she disclosed. Let me start by saying there have been gold standard studies before and after STEP that reached the opposite conclusion, that the group receiving prayer had better outcomes, she said. Really? I asked. Can you give me some examples? One of the first widely publicized studies was by Dr. Randolph Bird, published in 1988 in the peer-reviewed Southern Medical Journal, she said. It was a prospective, randomized, double-blinded, control study of 400 subjects. She explained that born-again Christians, both Catholics and Protestants, were given the patient's first name, condition, and diagnosis. They were instructed to pray to the Judeo-Christian God for a rapid recovery and for prevention of complications and death, in addition to other areas of prayer they believed to be beneficial to patients. What were the results? Patients in the prayer group had less congestive heart failure, fewer cardiac arrests, fewer episodes of pneumonia, and were less often intubated and ventilated, and needed less diuretic and antibiotic therapy, she said. That's very interesting, I replied. You think this study was scientifically sound? Well, I believe it was. Of course, in any study like this, you can't control for such things as people praying for themselves or other people praying for them outside the study, she said. What was the reaction when it came out? The journal got flack from readers who didn't like prayer being studied this way. One doctor wrote in to say the journal had done a disservice to the science of medicine and therefore to mankind in general. Well, that's pretty strong, I said. She smiled. I thought so, too. The editor wrote back to say Bird's article had been subjected to the usual peer review process and was judged to be a properly designed and executed scientific investigation. Then, a decade or so later, a replication study by Dr. William S. Harris and colleagues was published in the Archives of Internal Medicine. Were the results similar? This was a gold standard study of the effects of intercessory prayer on almost 1,000 consecutively admitted coronary patients. Half received prayer, the other half didn't. And again, the group that received prayer had better outcomes than the control group. Was there controversy this time as well? Even more, because this journal has a higher profile and the article was published in a cultural climate that was more hostile to the idea of prayer being studied scientifically. One critic even cited the biblical injunction against putting God to the test. I looked back over my notes. So let me get this straight, I said. These studies affirmed that the recipients of prayer had better outcomes than those who didn't receive prayer. Brown nodded. That's right. Well, now I was confused. Then why do you think STEP reached such a different conclusion? I asked. Ah, she said, that's where things get very intriguing. Brown began dissecting the STEP project by asking me an uncontroversial question. If you're going to study prayer, she said, wouldn't it be important who was praying, who they were praying to,